You're listening to the Reinvest Podcast, where each Tuesday we will show you how to reclaim, reconnect, and refocus your life by bringing you the top real estate professionals in the industry. We'll pull back the curtain so you can implement these tools and tactics to build generational wealth. Your hosts, Garrett Gatton and Seth Simonillo.
Well, thank you for joining us on episode 36 of the Reinvest Podcast, where Seth and I get to show you how to maximize your life through the power of real estate investing. It's a good day.
Real estate investing. It is a marathon, not a sprint.
It really is. And, you know, I think we've been realizing that more in the last couple weeks and months. But, you know, if it was easy, everybody would do it. And I was listening to a podcast where they were kind of critiquing maybe how oversold real estate investing is to people, portraying it as something that it's not. You know, it is a grind. It is difficult. It takes skill to do it. I think there's a difference between simple and easy. Mm-hmm. So in many ways, it is simple in terms of the inputs and outputs of real estate investing, but it is not easy.
Well, it's like that in a lot of things. Reading books are simple. Working out is simple.
Right.
But it takes discipline to do both of those things.
Right.
And it makes it not easy. It makes it hard. So
absolutely,
it is very much in that vein. So today we have a special guest on. We have Vessi with DBA Capital. Vessi, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it's good to have you on. So Vessi is the founder of DBA Capital and our Capital Group. What does DBA stand for? Does it stand for anything?
Doing business as. I'm just
kidding. Doing business as a capital group.
It's a dream, believe, achieve, actually.
Oh, wow.
It underlines with the my mission and philosophy, and that's, yeah. I can go into that.
Dream, believe, and achieve.
I like
wow,
that.
That's good. That I feel like that should be somewhere on your website. It probably is.
So your DBA is DBA Capital Group.
So yes,
I had to put one more
cheesy
of those
humor.
Jokes
all right, but anyway, so Vessi, you have a portfolio of investment real estate. It looks like in Florida, Tennessee, Georgia, mm-hmm. and then wow. Also very cool. You have a commercial lending background. So what's your commercial lending background look like, and how long were you doing commercial lending? Do you still do it now? Mm-hmm. What's going on there?
Yeah, so commercial lending is my W-2 job, which I still maintain while also running the investment portfolio on the side. I started that back during the Great Recession in 2008.
Wow.
So
good
very
time.
Interesting times, and we can talk about compare and contrast today's environment to 2008. But that's when I started. Almost all of my career has been in the international banking space, although I did have a couple of years where I primarily transitioned to our domestic group. Working with primarily US based middle market companies. And during that time, I also had the opportunity to bank commercial real estate investors, primarily in the multifamily space, commercial retail, maybe some hotels and other special purpose properties. So that's been really helpful as I eventually decided to be more active in the real estate investing space and having that lending experience, not only on the real estate side, but overall in underwriting, has been, I think, instrumental.
And so you said international banking?
Correct.
Give us a couple of examples of
for other people, not for us.
Asking for a friend.
Yeah, I'm happy to. It's so I focus on the middle market space, which effectively covers companies with revenues anywhere from 20 million to a billion. And I focus on U.S. subsidiaries of foreign parents or U.S. Headquartered companies that have global operations. And typically, the more international, the more complex they are.
Oh, I'm sure.
To the extent there is offshore collateral. That's where I get involved to provide a more customized solution that fits their business needs while at the same time meeting the risk parameters of the bank. And if there isn't a very heavy international component, then that usually gets underwritten by the domestic group. But
yeah,
to the extent they have core foreign operations, that's where I would step in.
So do you have to have a pretty extensive legal team to be able to consult with international law? I mean, that would be, you're dealing with, you know, like legal instruments essentially for companies that are operating, you know, overseas and in a place where they play by different rules. So
absolutely. Legal team, regulatory team, compliance team.
What's the close time on a loan with that?
Yeah, it's definitely very complex, but I enjoy it. There are a lot of moving pieces. And as you can imagine, it's not only understanding the business, but also the market, the geopolitical environment. So I'm always learning something new.
Wow. So are you're actively doing the international commercial lending still, right?
Yes, I'm still actively doing that.
Give us just maybe an example, without having to breach any confidentiality stuff, of one of the businesses that you're helping and kind of where are they located internationally?
Mm-hmm. I can speak in general terms. Let's say you're a US-based company that's selling overseas, and one day you decide to expand your operations, say, in Europe, because you've had some good traction there. And you can do that by either setting up an office and growing your presence there or acquiring another company there. So that's where I would step in. Say you decided to acquire a foreign company or foreign operations and kind of loop them in into your core. Mm-hmm. That's where I would step in and try to figure out how best to do that. Can we do that?
Right.
Are we comfortable doing that? Can we take collateral there? Are we comfortable with the debtors? What about the inventory risk? All these political risk, all these questions will come up as we evaluate that underlying acquisition, and is there sufficient cash flow to support that, and so forth.
Wow, that is fascinating.
So at what point within your lending background and lending career did you decide, mm-hmm, I think I want to invest in real estate?
That happened, I would say, around 2017 is when I made my very first investment. And really, initially, how it started was the idea to build a retirement nest egg and diversify away from the stock market. The clues were all around me, first with the 08 crisis. Of course, we all remember the Enron crisis, where a lot of people all of a sudden lost their stock portfolios and 401ks. And then over the years, my own employer went through a couple of restructures, and I wasn't laid off, but I didn't think that I was any special or any more special than my colleagues, who unfortunately had to part ways. So those clues that were all around didn't really, they were all around me, but I just didn't, I guess, notice them at the moment. And in 2017, it all kind of culminated where I thought I need to do something. I need to take action. And that very first home was really the first step that I took investing in real estate.
If you got in 2017, you probably got in at the right time.
I mean, it's been an up market, pretty much since 2010, 2011. But again, when I evaluate investments, I'm not trying to necessarily time the market, but make sure that the underlying numbers work. Yeah. And that's really, I think, what made that very first investment a successful one and ultimately led me to further expand and grow.
What was your first investment? Was it a single family house? Was it a small multi or?
Yes, it was a single family home out of state. So I'm based in Los Angeles. I love living here, but investing is challenging because it's difficult to get properties to cash flow unless you put a lot of money down or buy all cash. And I didn't really have that amount of liquidity. And secondly, the regulatory environment is not very landlord friendly. So I made the conscious decision to take a leap of faith, take that calculated risk, if you will, and invest out of state. So I purchased a single family home in Tennessee, and that's how it all got started.
Oh, wow. Do you still have that home?
I do. Yes.
Wow.
I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure the appreciation has been like over the last 5 or 6 years.
It has been great. I wasn't really counting on it because specifically, and it's in Memphis. Specifically, Memphis is more of a steady Eddie market. You won't see the big spikes, but also you won't see the big downfalls.
Right.
I really invested for cash flow and really happy I made that decision. I've been able to refinance the property since, and at this point, it's basically infinite returns. I've gotten all my money back.
Yeah. Wow. That's awesome. That's powerful.
You know, we've commented on this show a number of times that there are kind of affiliate real estate professionals, commercial lending, commercial real estate brokers and agents, and, you know, attorneys, people that are helping investors every day and are watching the strategies in real time. And so many of them never like take up that for themselves, you know? Mm-hmm. I think it's incredible that you saw the signs. You said, hey, you know, I'm helping people do loans all the time. Real estate's a big part of what we do. Maybe I could actually capitalize on being, you know, the owner and the holder of the real estate. You know, there's a lot of agents here, even in our area, that will not do that. And, you know, you got to keep selling if you want to keep making money, but real estate offers something different. So you're a problem solver. That's obviously very clear in your international lending background, commercial lending. So what were some of the skill sets that translated for you as you became an investor?
Mm-hmm. I would say really the ability to evaluate those investments from a more conservative angle and knowing how a lender would eventually look at it when the time comes for me to apply for a loan, how they will sensitize the numbers, and really think through the key risk factors of the investment. And usually the people who know me know that when I evaluate deals, I always start with these are the key risks. And now let's at the end talk about the positives, right? Because when you look at an investment, you always like to start with the end in mind and what is the exit strategy. Hopefully right. You'll have multiple exit strategies. And then from there on, dive into the market, the sub-market, and then the underlying assets. So being able to analyze that on the lender side and knowing how underwriting works, what are the things the lenders look at? What are some of the diligence reports that will be required? How to read those, how to interpret those, why do they matter? All of that has been instrumental in helping me be a successful investor.
So in the underwriting phase, it's been huge because it's kind of like everybody has partners, right? Everybody has Uncle Sam as a partner. And in most real estate deals, you have a bank or a lender as a partner. Mm-hmm. And that partner has specific expectations and obligations, right? So you're coming from that lens and saying, listen, you know, if I can't make it make sense to a bank, it probably isn't going to make sense to me. Is that fair to say? Or
that's fair to say. And also knowing how to interpret and understand the rules, right? How to read a credit agreement. Why is it important? What to look for in the credit agreement to, again, ensure that you're following what you promised to do when you signed that loan, because I really appreciate the fact that you use the name partner, because at the end of the day, the lender is usually your biggest partner, bringing in anywhere from 50 to 80% of the capital. So it's important to know what the rules are, why they set those rules. And usually it's all risk driven. So it's for a good reason, risk mitigation driven.
Yeah. I didn't have this as a question on our outline, but I am curious. Everybody who's acquired a piece of property before with a bank or a lender involved, your hand hurts by the end of how many signatures you have to put on these papers, right? And we had a client one time that's like, I'm going to read every word of the operation, the mortgage agreement and stuff. And so we're like, hey, you need to like do that on your own time, because we're not going to sit here for 8 hours for you to do that. But God bless them. So, I guess what I'm saying is everybody's kind of like, you know, signed the piece of paper without realizing all of the legal jargon in there. What do you see as some of the common clauses, agreements, things that the bank puts into a commercial loan agreement that is most overlooked by investors, but really important?
And I'll speak more from the commercial lending side, because that's the space that I play in. Really, it comes down to the covenants and compliance requirements. It feels to me that sometimes investors are surprised by what are the reporting requirements. Everyone knows about the minimum debt service coverage, but there are other covenants in place, known as negative covenants, around no pledge of assets, no additional indebtedness. So if you decide to, if for whatever reason, say you need additional capital infusion and you want to put a loan in place to pay yourself some interest, you might not be able to do that if your loan agreement actually prohibits that. Doesn't mean you cannot put it in place, but it would require for you to have a conversation with your lender. Otherwise, you're basically breaking that loan agreement and effectively in performance default.
So are you saying, like, maybe in a syndication scenario where one of the general partners would put up capital as a loan to the syndication entity, that would not be kosher under some loan agreements?
Correct. Unless it's carved out up front or negotiated up front. And again, some lenders may not really have appetite for having other creditors, if you will, in the mix. That's usually the case. They wouldn't want you to pledge the collateral that they've already encumbered. Because if something was to go wrong, now they have a few more cooks in the kitchen
So
it's important to understand those restrictions and covenants up front. Reporting requirements is another one where you may have your personal financial statement, say you're a loan guarantor or a key principal, that may be required annually, usually within a certain time frame. And again, if you don't deliver that, basically it's an event of default. Now, again, I don't think the lender would automatically foreclose on you just because of that. Usually they'll send you a letter and kind of remind you, hey, you're past due on that, and work with you in most cases, right? But it's the little things and that one should pay attention to, and at least the credit agreement, I would say, if nothing else, at least read that and understand that, so you know what the rules of the road are up front.
That's super beneficial to have to partner with somebody like yourself on the investor side, because and you know, you're a commercial lender still, so plug your ears, but banks can be some of the trickiest to work with, because they don't tell you all of the nuances before you go through the underwriting process. And A, you have to have a lender that is anticipating those things or really holding your hand through the process. Or B, you have to have a lot of experience having gone through them to know what you need to look out for, like you're saying. So to partner with somebody from the get-go that can navigate those choppy waters is a huge asset.
And it seems like lenders sometimes just move the goalposts. They're like, you know, a month ago I would have done this, but now, sorry, I know we said we probably would. We gave you a soft commit. we're out.
We were doing a multifamily loan on an acquisition, a small acquisition here in our area a couple of years ago. And we had a loan commitment from a regional bank that said, hey, we're going to do, you know, X terms, and here's the, you know, the sheet of our loan commitment to you. And we got ready into the point where we were going to move forward with underwriting the loan. And they said, hey, sorry, we reached our saturation limit for multifamily in this asset class. So, you know, now the terms are going to be this. And it just totally skewed the deal. And we ended up having to go with a different lender. But it was like last minute surprise, you know. So having somebody like yourself would be awesome to be able to partner with and do that. What pitfalls did you see from the lending side? Looking kind of into the investment realm, what pitfalls did you see that when you became an investor, you knew you wanted to avoid? What mistakes were investors making that you saw?
Really, it kind of comes down to two things. One is being appropriately capitalized and making sure there is adequate liquidity, either for the underlying deal and raising the appropriate amount of capital up front, as well as making sure they have adequate liquidity. And again, most lenders look at 10% of the loan amount, especially once you start going into the agency space. And that's for a reason, right? You have to have that rainy day reserve or rainy day fund. So that's number one. And number two is, so cash, number one and number two, cash flow, making sure you have adequate cash flow to service the property. There is a reason why lenders have the 125 times debt service cover requirement. It gives them, it gives one some cushion, right? And kind of forces you so you're not operating on the edge all the time. But at the same time, you don't want to be too close to that 125 times debt service requirement. So usually you want to start off at 150, maybe 160 debt service cover, because unexpected things do happen.
Always happen.
Inevitably, yeah. Always happen. So you need to have that cushion to react. And especially when you have investors, obviously you don't want to be running and operating on very thin margins.
So as you've done your underwriting for the deals that you've acquired, what are some of the underwriting standards that it, you're like, if I can, what do you feel comfortable with? Is that like, you know, you like to have your DSCR at like 1.5, 1.6, you know, typically what do you like to have in cash reserves? I know it varies from deal to deal, but just kind of as best practice.
Yeah. And I speak to my personal underwriting criteria, because those of course vary and everyone has a different risk tolerance. So usually for reserves, I look at roughly 6 months of operating reserves and debt service. So I'd like to have those covered. And then when for any CapEx improvements, depending on the size and complexity of the project, adding anywhere from 10 to 20% cushion there as well, because as we've experienced right in the past couple of years, labor and materials could drastically increase from month to month. So you want to account or at least partially mitigate some of those unexpected surprises. So that's for reserves. When it comes to the P&L and the operating statement, of being more conservative in the rent growth assumptions, as well as the vacancy. I've had some lenders that are pretty aggressive, even as an investor, right? Going there and looking for loans and sometimes surprised by some of the assumptions that they would make. But you really want to be more aligned with where the market is and where the market has historically been versus plugging in rules of thumbs like 5% for vacancy and 10% for maintenance, things like that. Definitely making sure you adjust for insurance and taxes. Again, I'm sometimes surprised, not all lenders would do that, but especially in the current environment and insurance is killing a lot of deals, so not as much rates. So these are the things that people need to account for. So these are things that I've kind of picked up over the years and have incorporated in my own underwriting.
Wow.
Yeah, that's helpful.
So share your opinion then kind of on that. Where are we now from a lending kind of landscape, the market? And you alluded to this earlier. How does that contrast to 2008, 2009? It's not a lot of people continued through both market cycles. You know what I'm saying? So it's... You have really good insight because you were able to see both. You know, you're living one now and you went through the other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say in terms of fundamentals, right, that has remained the same. Meaning if you have the liquidity in the balance sheet, the liquidity reserves, and if you're focused on cash flow, that will help carry you through stormy waters. And even in 08, as I was working with clients, those who had some volatility in the cash flow or the P&L were able to weather the storm because they had very strong balance sheets, high liquidity, high net worth to carry them through. So from that perspective and the storm that we're going through or about to go through, right, those will be key fundamentals that will carry through. I think the interesting thing is when comparing 08 to the current market environment, what happened in 08 is, again, the single family or the residential home market where lending standards were not the same as they are today. People, anyone could get a loan. Anyone who could breathe could get a loan.
Oh, those were the days.
And, you know, a lot of properties or a lot of people got too leveraged, right? They took on too much debt. And when the markets shifted, all of a sudden they were underwater. I think at least on the residential space that has changed, but I do see a lot of similarities in the commercial space where in the past couple of years post-COVID, there are a lot of people who underwrote properties based on pro formas versus actuals, levered those properties up pretty heavily, 80 to 90%. And now when the markets are shifting due to the rapid increase in interest rates, and lenders haven't really changed their fundamentals, right? They would still look at the debt service cover. And if you're not sizing up to that, they will likely reduce the loan proceeds, which is why you're seeing lower LTVs in the current market environment. So they're kind of pushing you that way for a good reason. But unfortunately, I think in the commercial space, we'll see somewhat similar scenario that we saw in the residential back in 08, where people got too leveraged. The valuations are adjusting based on the current market dynamics and interest rate environment. Rents are also slowing down, which of course is impacting cash flow. So unfortunately, I think we'll see some people in a lot of pain with those short-term variable rate loans that are coming due this year and next year.
How long do you think it's going to take for people to kind of go through the pain points and then be forced to make a decision?
That's a great question, and one I've been struggling with myself, because even as I'm looking for properties to buy, there still seems to be a disconnect between buyers and sellers. If you already own a property and you see you're in trouble, usually you want to have at least a year out outlook and take action right before it's too late. But it feels to me that some sellers are in denial, and if they bought the property a while back, right, they probably have some good equity built in, and probably those loans will be okay. But the ones who bought in the last year or so that have variable rate loans, that...
Yeah, it's a scary place to be.
Exactly. So not sure how long that will take, but at some point there will be a credit event, either a loan maturity or a lender stepping in and asking you to fix that rate. And for most loans, unless they're bank loans, that usually happens with interest rate caps, which have become exorbitantly expensive. So unless you have deep pockets to bring that additional capital, hopefully not via Capital Co at the expense of your investors, but I think we've already started to hear more and more of these capital calls taking place. You either sell the property or you hand it to the lender, or you need to bring a very strong capital partner in the deal to kind of help avoid that worst case scenario.
In the lending world, is there any kind of talk in maybe the higher ups of the lending world of an end in sight of the interest rate increases? Or, I mean, is the feel from you guys and your coworkers, and I mean, is it just kind of, for the foreseeable future, it's going to keep stair-stepping, or is there a plateau coming, or even a downward trajectory?
I mean, I think nobody has a crystal ball, right? So we're all kind of watching and looking at the same markets, market news that everyone's reading, and specifically the guidance that the Fed is giving. So I think unfortunately, with what transpired with some of the in the banking world as of the last couple of weeks, right, with SVB, Signature, and so forth, I think that will probably cause the Fed to slow down a little bit, a lot of it in terms of rate hikes. Maybe there will be one more rate hike and they'll kind of stay steady until the end of the year. Inflation is still high. It's coming down, maybe not as fast as the Fed wants it to, but they're in a very, very tough spot right now, because if they keep raising rates, that will cause even more distress. They have said that they want to slow down the economy. So it's been pretty clear that the recession is around the corner, or at least that's what their statement suggests is coming. So I think probably another rate hike, maybe hold steady, and sometime next year, first quarter, potentially start reducing rate. We also have an election coming up next year. So I think that may drive some decisions as well. Will rates go down to the level we experienced in the past couple of years? I don't know. I don't think so. I think the long-term average has been around 5 or 6, and maybe that's where we'll settle down. But a lot could happen that may change those decisions.
Well, and you know, having high interest rates or higher than what we've experienced in the last few years is not a bad thing, assuming that prices are relative to what makes sense. And that's, I think, the correction that we're waiting to see. And I agree with you from a real estate, commercial real estate perspective. On the agent side, there is a disconnect still from buyers and sellers. I think that's starting to kind of soften a little bit, to where people are, you know, you're seeing longer days on market. It is hard. Sellers are realizing that deals aren't closing with as much surety as they used to, because buyers have to go through a new level of due diligence with lenders, and lenders are changing standards. And so I think that's slowly kind of coming into the minds of people who are looking to sell their properties, to say, I think I take a lower offer with a buyer that I feel more sure about than somebody who's going to give me my, you know, just outlandish price that maybe I saw 12 months ago. So how should investors, our listener base, people that you're talking to that are in the space, be positioning themselves as maybe lending standards tighten and we start to move more into difficult waters?
Yeah, so it really comes down right to the, first of all, being conservative up front. It's a lot of people say you make your money when you buy the property, right? Make sure it's valued correctly. That you're underwriting with appropriate reserves and cushion. So if unexpected things do happen, you're prepared. And starting with a maybe bigger war chest, meaning more cash reserves. Now, again, the lenders would typically size up the deal to the debt service cover to make sure it cash flows with adequate cushion. And in the current environment, that's leading to lower LTVs. Yeah. So for a lot of operators, that means that they'll have to, for better or worse, raise more capital up front, not only to cover that gap, but also to build those additional reserves, which is creating the disconnect between buyers and sellers, right? And the minimum return requirements that investors have. So building those reserves and investor database, so when the time comes for them to close on a deal, they have that capital needed to close and execute.
Yeah, that's good. And that came really out of one of the big clear messages from the Best Ever Conference was, hey, now's the time to make a pivot. Get your ego out of the way. Mm-hmm. Don't wait till it's too late. So,
absolutely.
All right, now we're going to go into our smaller pockets. So, Vessi, why don't you go ahead and tell us about one of your worst real estate deals? What happened? What went wrong? And then most importantly, what did you learn from it so our listeners can avoid the same mistake?
Okay. Well, and I'll talk about a deal that we closed on a year ago. I wouldn't necessarily call it the worst deal, but I had a very big seminar going through the diligence process. As an investor, I built a Chinese wall, if you will, between my W-2 and my managing my own investor portfolio. So when I found and sourced the very first multifamily deal, it was an 11-unit joint venture. There was one particular lender I had been working with in terms of evaluating properties, because it's important to vet the numbers by third parties when you're doing that preliminary underwrite. So that particular lender was always very responsive. And I thought the right thing to do, right, when I find a deal, it will be his to lose effectively, because he had invested by that time a lot of time, right, with me to provide me those preliminary term sheets. So we got the deal under contract. Great terms, everything was going fine. And then the Fed started raising rates right around March of last year. So of course I knew things could change very rapidly. So I was checking in with him more frequently. And I'll never forget the day, it was on a Friday. He said, yep, we're still good, no worries. And then on a Monday morning, I get an email, not even a phone call, saying, sorry, we're putting our loan products on freeze. Good luck. And wow. I was like, oh my God, wow. what did I do? So it was very stressful. Obviously, I had commitments to the broker and the seller, my partners. Of course, what do you do when a storm hits you? You turn into problem-solving mode. And at that point of time, I had spoken with a few other lenders, so started reaching out to them to see if there is an opportunity for them to take a look at our deal, which there was. Eventually, I also called the broker. Couldn't really, you don't want to be hiding bad news, but you also don't want to drop the bad news and run. So by the time I called the broker, I already had a plan of action of this is how mm-hmm. many lenders we've contacted.
Yeah.
This is the feedback. These are the timelines to at least give him the reassurance we're not walking away right. from a deal that made sense to all of us. But it was a good learning lesson. I just assume that everyone operates in the same manner that I do as a lender.
Yeah.
Transparent communication and no last minute surprises and kind of outlining these are the parameters, right, that are firm and these are the parameters that may change, right, subject to XYZ diligence yeah. items. That didn't happen. So it was a lesson learned. Work with multiple lenders when you have a deal. That was my seminar. And some people don't like that because they feel like they're being shopped around. But as an investor, I also like to have certainty of close. So having a couple options lined up never hurts. And
so how does that practically work itself out? Like, let's say you have a deal, you got it mm-hmm. under contract, and now you're mm-hmm. going to reach out to, maybe you've already had some soft commitments and you've kind of sent some preliminary emails. Hey, looks like we're going to get a deal here soon. What are your, you know, what could you do for us? Mm-hmm. How do you have multiple lenders working for you, and when do you make a commitment to just one of them? Yeah,
I think the key, reach out to 3 to 5. That's kind of where we started. You don't want to overextend yourself. And in some cases, it was direct lenders. In other cases, it was mortgage brokers, right? And so they reach out probably to some of the same lenders, and there was some overlap. In fact, one of the mortgage brokers we reached out to said, no, you've already reached out to 5 other people. I'm like, I don't want to participate. So I was like, okay, great. Let's learn. But they give you that preliminary information, and based on that, you figure out, okay, that seems to work best in terms of terms, the numbers, and we decided ultimately to proceed with one of those lenders where the numbers make sense. And of course, at that point of time, certainty of close and closing timelines were important. We ended up getting an extension. We had to mm-hmm. because of everything that had transpired. But the timeline was also a factor. And to your point earlier in the conversation, yeah, rate was important, but not the most important factor. From that point of time, we were maybe less price sensitive because we had to close. And that's something else to take into consideration.
Wow. Yeah, those are good lessons. And you said, I think your seminar, you know, I've heard tuition, fill in whatever word you want to use for painful lessons that you'll never forget. Very good. Well, Vessi, one of our show segments we call our little nugget. So we're looking for one practical takeaway or piece of advice that our listeners can implement to their businesses. What do you got for us?
Being a numbers person, I would say listen to the numbers. Don't fall in love with the deal. I know this is very hard, especially when you're an investor and you'd like to grow your portfolio, but don't do that at all cost. At the end of the day, and I think we talked about it at the beginning of the call, real estate is a marathon. It's not a sprint. It takes time to build and grow wealth and build and grow that portfolio. So listen to the numbers and be conservative.
I would add on that and just reinforce what you said with being patient, right? So there's a couple of reasons that somebody would want to maybe throw caution to the wind and let their emotions drive them. If you're a new investor and you're ready to get your first deal, that anxiousness to start and get off the sidelines is very strong. And that might cause somebody to overlook what the numbers are saying just to get a deal started. So, you know, that would be one scenario to be cautious of. And then another one is you're an established investor and you've got people come and say, we need to, you know, invest my money, and you get paid on transactions as a syndicator. And so you're looking for a deal just to have some activity to be able to talk to people about. That would be another reason that you would want to, you know, heed the advice that you gave in terms of being objective. We just walked away from, it was a small deal, but nonetheless, it was one where we kept looking at it, and, you know, you walk through the property a couple more times, and then you start to kind of see with a new set of eyes than you, when you first looked at it. It went from, wow, this has got a ton of upside, to this needs a lot of work. Could we do it? Yeah, we could. Do we want to do it? No, we do not. And so we let it go, and at so much peace in after having walked away from that. And I think when you walk away from a deal that in your gut you know that you shouldn't move forward with, you know you made the right decision when you feel a sense of relief.
Absolutely, yes. The loss could be could far outweigh the potential gains that you saw in the scenario, right, that you described. So having that objectivity is important. And that's where I think partners also help.
Yes.
Because if you're doing this by yourself, I mean, sure, you could be level-headed and maybe go through that process, but it's helpful to be able to talk through those key points with partners, and maybe they will pull you back when the time comes.
The voice of reason on our team is Dave. Dave is... I would call him a pessimist. He would call himself a realist.
Everyone needs a Dave, though.
You know, he's the voice of reason that, and he just cuts through all the crap. And he's like, okay, this is really where we're at and what's going on. And this is how it's going to happen if you move forward with this. And you just need someone to level with you, brass tacks, and be honest with you. But in closing, Vessi, what's been one of the greatest resources for your real estate investing career?
That's a great question. I think in terms of underwriting, picking the right underwriting model, and of course, there's a ton of information on researching markets and submarkets. I can list a number of websites, but really using the data to guide my decisions and make those investment decisions. And again, going back to relying on the numbers. So the data and the numbers.
What are a couple of websites that you like to use to evaluate other markets?
Absolutely. So in terms of the bigger picture, starting with Bureau of Labor and Statistics for employment rate and underlying economics, the census for underlying population growth, as far as some of the aggregator sites, which ultimately source from these two, are the Department of Numbers, City Data, Best Places, Data.io, and then for submarkets, looking at Spot Crime, the Census Reporter, to help drill down into median household income. But if you were to start with two, I would say the Census and the Bureau of Labor and Statistics to start with.
Yeah. Very cool. Very cool. And then lastly, how can people follow your success and what you're doing with DBA Capital Group?
The easiest way to connect with me is through my site, www.dbacapitalgroup.com. As we said, D for dream, B believe, A achieve. My email, phone number are there, as well as a link to my direct calendar. I also recently published a complimentary digital book, The Busy Professional's Quick Guide to Investing in Multifamily, really designed to educate and empower investors and help simplify some of the concepts so they can get that process started and be more empowered in the investment process. And that's, people can subscribe. I issue a bi-weekly newsletter. That's also, there is a link to that on my website. So I'll say that's probably the easiest way to start.
Awesome. We will have all of that. Please go check out her ebook to get educated and just add another tool to your tool belt.
Yep.
Vessi, it's been awesome to have you on. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it, Gareth and Seth.
Awesome. Thank you. As always, excited that you joined us on another episode of the Reinvest Podcast. If this episode added to your tool belt or left you feeling inspired, go ahead and share it with a friend. Stay tuned every Tuesday for new episodes. And if you want to get in touch with us, go to our LinkedIn or Facebook profiles and shoot us a message. Move farther, reach higher, and grow deeper. See you next time.